Have you ever wished that you could go back in time and speak to some of the interesting figures of history? Well, I recently had that experience. I was at one of my favorite places in the world. You've heard me say it before, and I'll say it again, Colonial Williamsburg. And while I was there, I was interviewing a number of people who are interpreters, that is, actors who portray historical figures. And sheerly by coincidence, I happened to interview the interpreter who plays Patrick Henry at the same time as I interviewed the interpreter who plays James Madison. And as we sat there looking at each other, I said, "You guys were on different sides of the ratification debate. Why don't we have a debate right here and right now?" And by golly, they did it. I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly constitutional, and our subject today is the Madison versus Henry ratification smackdown.
Your weekly constitutional is produced at WETS-FM in cooperation with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in Grundy, Virginia.
This is the third and final part of our three-part series on one of my favorite places in the world, Colonial Williamsburg. Now, if you've been listening over the last couple of weeks, you've heard me speak with Cash Earhart, who is an interpreter there of many different roles and who gave us the background of Williamsburg, both the city itself and the modern colonial Williamsburg. You've heard me speak to people like Francis Burroughs and Lisa Huvel, all about their roles in electronic communication and education. You've heard me speak to Bill Weldon, who plans a lot of the programs there. And you've heard me speak to Bill White, who's in charge of pretty much everything that happens in that part of Colonial Williamsburg. And that's all been fascinating, and it's all been great. But I hope you all will forgive me, folks, when I say that I've saved my favorite for the last, because I had an experience while I was there that I didn't anticipate. It was one of those serendipitous moments when things just come together. You see, my buddy Cash had arranged all of these interviews, and he put two of them together, probably just for scheduling reasons, or maybe there was more going on there. Maybe Cash was actually anticipating what happened. But what happened is this. The interpreters who play James Madison and Patrick Henry showed up at the same time. And as we sat there, I looked at them and I said, guys, let's do this in character, and then we'll come back and we'll do it out of character. And by the way, weren't James Madison and Patrick Henry on opposite sides of the ratification debate? Wasn't Patrick Henry just as opposed to ratifying the Constitution as James Madison was in favor of it? Didn't they have a titanic struggle at the Virginia Ratification Convention? And they looked at me and they said, "Well, yeah." And I said, "Well, let's have a debate. Don't talk to me. Talk to each other. I'll just ask a question or two as we go along." And those guys jumped right in, and all I did, basically, as you'll hear, is sit back and just lob a few questions in every now and then. This is all about Madison. It's all about Henry. Just sit back and enjoy it.
By way of polite introduction, my name is Henry, Patrick Henry, Jr., Esquire, at your service. I was first appointed to the House of Burgesses back in 1765. In fact, introduced some resolutions against the hated Stamp Act at that time. Since that time, I have served in the Grand Congress prior to our Declaration of Independence. Here in Williamsburg City, I was one of the delegates to the 5th Convention, which actually declared independence. In fact, my worthy associate was first come to public office in that convention. I also had the very high and unmerited honor to serve as the first elected governor of the Commonwealth. And most recently, last June, I was one of the leading opponents to the consolidated government that Mr. Madison helped to create.
And Mr. Madison, the worthy person you mentioned a moment ago, is sitting right next to you. Could you tell us a bit about yourself, sir?
Yes, as my honest friend here said, James Madison, Jimmy, to my friends, and I have the pleasure in this year of 1789 of indeed passing the ratification of that most excellent document that I pray shall guide this new fledgling nation forward. I first began in this humble work of nation building in 1776, serving with my worthy friend here upon the 5th Virginia Convention, which indeed did declare independence, set up Virginia with a Declaration of Rights and Constitution. Over the past several years, I have served upon the Confederation Congress, witnessed its inadequacies firsthand, and played, I flatter myself, a pivotal role in establishing a new constitution, one that, as I said, shall ensure that the rights of Americans be protected for years to come.
Well, sir, I'm going to pick up on that last point that you made, because I think that, in fact, was the very question that was debated in the late ratification process, wasn't it? And the one where you and Mr. Henry may disagree to the greatest extent. Does, in fact, our Constitution as of 1789, does it adequately protect individual rights?
I say no. In fact, I find it highly curious that Mr. Madison even mentioned the Declaration of Rights. You must know, we Virginians do things in the proper manner. First, we composed a Declaration of Rights, and then we wrote a framework of government, a constitution, the idea being that the primary purpose of a government is to secure those individual liberties. And yet, in Philadelphia City, when this constitution was being drawn up, again, largely under the control of Mr. Madison, they determined that they did not require a Bill of Rights.
I humbly answer my friend here, for it seems he thinks me some schemer, like a spider sitting and orchestrating these different plots.
Well,
and
I
remind you to say, sir, that it takes many heads and many hands to craft a government. 'Twas the fear of many men that should we write every single federal right down, what then becomes to the rights we do not enumerate? Indeed, I should say there is great danger in that. And I remind both gentlemen here that what we did at that most excellent and honorable Congress did nothing to override any state document that exists. The rights lay properly enumerated within the states. This new federal constitution does nothing to exclude that. Indeed, I expect the rights are better protected for that reason.
Pish. Implied powers to Congress. What we require, what this, I dare say the Bill of Rights is indispensably necessary, more so in this government than ever it was in any government before. What we require is a doctrine of reserved rights that will secure to the people and the states every right not conceded to the general government. Right now, of course, we have a promise that there will be a Bill of Rights to come in future. I shall believe it when I see it.
What do you think of Mr. Madison's argument that a statement of individual rights is unnecessary given that the new national government is divided against itself into three parts? Won't that prevent tyranny?
Nay, sir. I believe that the state of the republic is in extreme danger, especially because with this Constitution, the sovereignty of the people of Virginia, where those rights were secured in our Declaration of Rights, are now rendered insecure or lost altogether.
It is a curious thing for you to say, Mr. Henry, that the republic is now in more danger than it was before. For indeed, we saw before the sovereignty of the states stepping upon one another as petulant children. We had a coach of six, unrigged. 13 horses running about in several different directions. Now, we have not taken any power away from those horses, merely rigged them up properly so that they may be guided forward instead of all the different directions they were guided under. We witnessed the danger of state sovereignty when they combated against one another. They had no power, and moreover, I say, we cannot rely on popular virtue of justice any longer, Mr. Henry. You must understand that.
Oh, indeed I do. In fact, one of my greatest reservations with the Constitution is that the rights and the liberties of the people depend on the single chance of men being virtuous enough to make laws to punish themselves. Show me that age and country where the rights and liberties of the people depended on the sole chance of their rulers being good men without a consequent loss of liberty.
Mr. Madison.
And furthermore,
begging your pardon, sir, for this
interruption, but I warrant you, the Articles of Confederation, which bound us loosely together in a confederation, were admittedly imperfect. They could have been improved, and they could have been strengthened. In fact, that was the purpose of the convention in Philadelphia in 87 in the first place. But you did not improve the Articles, sir. What you did is scrap them all together and come out with something completely new.
But you agree, sir, that changes were necessary.
I warrant you that the Articles of Confederation were imperfect. At the same time, however, sir, they got us through the war.
But you warrant that they were imperfect.
Indeed.
Mr. Madison, a moment ago, Mr. Henry mentioned a promise to adopt a Bill of Rights, even though he doubted that it would be fulfilled. Could you give us an update on that process?
Yes, yes. In my contemplations, though I initially thought such a Bill of Rights would be a parchment barrier in protecting the rights of Americans, I see no further harm in ensuring they lie enumerated. Through several conversations and correspondences I have held with men like Mr. Jefferson, Governor Morris, Edmund Randolph, such esteemed gentlemen, I have thought such a bill would be ideal in this new government and further protect the rights of its citizens, so long as they do nothing to rob any power from the states.
And so are you in the process of putting together such a Bill of Rights? What's happening?
Well, I should say, sir, the first step, of course, is getting elected to that Congress.
Ah, I see. I see. Well, then, and then you intend.
It is my expectation and hope, sir.
It should be quite a simple matter, really, Madison, because I gave you 20 proposals as to what that Bill of Rights should look like.
Oh, aye, sir, and I shall take them all into account, I can assure you of that.
I do not feel assured, though. When, sir, if you would have seen how vigorously they opposed the proposal of a Bill of Rights in the first place, it would give you pause before you actually believed that you would ever see a Bill of Rights.
It is the same matter I have said before. What have we done to undermine the state's Declaration of Rights and our establishment of a federal government? We have done no such thing. The states hold all the authority they held before. Only now we have an overarching government that can assure the states function in Congress, in unison with one another, to properly negotiate trade, to set up unified treaties, to adhere to the law of nations.
You will pardon me if I'm not so secure in Mr. Madison's assertions that the powers of the states are left intact, for they are not. I, frankly, would wish to know, and perhaps you can tell us here, sir, why it was omitted to secure us that property in slaves which we now hold. My fear is that its omission was done with design. For the Congress, according to the Constitution, has power to lay and collect taxes, imposts, and excises. Imposts and excises are to be uniform, but this uniformity does not extend to taxes. This might compel the southern states to liberate their slaves.
Mr. Henry, you have expressed opinions countless times for your disdain for the institution of slavery, but have said, and I do agree with you, that it is a sad necessity to have. This new constitution is destined for the change that our nation will face. Now, we see no end towards slavery at this present moment, but one day perhaps we shall. And so it was discussed in that convention how best we might negotiate and prepare for that change so it does not disestablish our union when it does so.
I do not expect that in my lifetime I shall see the end of slavery.
Nor mine, but this government is not just for your lifetime, but for all posterity, Mr. Henry.
Upon that head, certainly, sir, we are agreed. The problem that I have, however, is that a majority of the states lie north of the Potomac. Your slaves are all south of that mighty river. My concern is that as that majority to the north is frequently is increasing in calling for the abolition of the institution of slavery, that they are going to dictate the terms to our grandchildren as to when slavery shall be abolished.
And we must look, sir, to the opposite end. For indeed, if Virginia stayed simply Virginia, and this union stayed scattered, only legislated by an agreement of goodwill, would this disunified nation one day wage war against itself, as Europe has done countless times, with 13 independent states waging war against one another? At least now, with some document they may look to as centralized law, we might prevent that.
I am of the view that this Constitution will actually provoke a civil war betwixt us.
Let's hope not. But Mr. Henry, a moment ago, you mentioned slavery. And at the risk of giving offense, I must point out at least an apparent contradiction between your concern with individual rights on the one hand and your apparent support of the institution of slavery. Do you have any comment on that, sir?
As Mr. Madison has correctly stated, I deplore the system of slavery. As we ought to admire that decree of heaven which has numbered us among the free, so too ought we to lament and deplore the necessity of holding our fellow men in bondage. However, there is a profound difference in our plight as we were struggling for liberty with Great Britain
and the plight of our slaves. A long-established principle in the laws of men, the laws of nations, for these 6,000 years nearly, since this earth was created by Almighty God, has been that a conquered people surrenders its rights and liberties unto the conquering power. We are not a conquered people, nor have we ever been. We, in fact, were the descendants of the British conquerors. Thus, no power on this earth could remove from us our God-given rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of property. Our slaves, on the other hand, as a conquered people, surrendered those rights. They are instead property.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're going back in time in one of the best time machines I know of, and that, of course, is Colonial Williamsburg. And we're listening to the two interpreters who interpret Patrick Henry and James Madison, and they're debating the ratification of the Constitution of the United States. We just heard from Patrick Henry, who was telling us why he thought slavery in the United States was justified. After the break, we'll hear from James Madison. Stay tuned. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we're talking to two interpreters at Colonial Williamsburg, the fellow who plays Patrick Henry and the one who plays James Madison. Before the break, they were debating slavery, or at least they were answering questions about slavery that I asked them. And Patrick Henry had explained that because African Americans were a conquered people, they had given up their right to freedom. Now let's see what James Madison says about that peculiar institution.
Again, I must say, as Mr. Henry did say, our grandfathers were indeed the conquerors, and their grandfathers the conquerees. Indeed, I expect as times change, we must see some liberation. Now, I can only speak so much, for indeed my family does hold 100 souls in slavery. But we must, of course, recognize that these poor wretches suffering under the institution count as both people and property. And counting as both, we see the complexities of laws made, indeed, in legislating the institution of slavery. For indeed, we have seen the 3/5 compromise that was established within that convention, as well as other legislation that has passed. But we must find some delicate half-step in ensuring that we progress forward. For indeed, as industry does increase and agriculture does increase, we may find some end down the road, perhaps beyond our own lifetime, where we might end that dreadful institution of slavery.
At the risk of opening an old wound and shifting focus from this fascinating subject, could we discuss another individual right, and specifically the right of religious freedom?
Oh, zounds.
The two of you, I seem to recall, were at odds just a few years ago with regard to an assessment, a religious assessment that was proposed by Mr. Henry and opposed by Mr. Madison. I wonder if you could explain to me your differing opinions on that subject.
Simply put, Mr. Madison and his master, Mr. Jefferson, who at the time was in France, are delusional. They seem to believe that the nature of man is so good, and so pure, and so generous, that if left to their own devices, men will freely and happily give of themselves, of their treasure, to those who are suffering around them, and that they will give those monies freely unto anyone who would serve as a minister to their local flock, to their parish. Regretfully, this is not the nature of man. We are prone to sin. We are prone to having our appetites outweigh our virtue, and we saw that very clearly from 1776 when we disestablished the Church of England in Virginia and till 1783 with the Treaty of Paris. In just that eight-year period of time, we saw a steady but very noticeable decline in morality and virtue in Virginia. My assessment bill, which called for in a small way, a return to the old way of life, because that's all we'd ever known, was an established church. Everyone paid a tax to support the Church of England and that one church alone, even though one did not subscribe to that particular church. We do have a diversity of religions in our country, to certain. Presbyterians, Baptists, Lutherans, Quakers, Mennonites, Moravians, Dunkards, Swedenborgians, Methodists, and I all the while certainly did believe that it was unjust that they had to pay a tax to support a church to which they themselves did not belong. But we must encourage virtue and morality. We must encourage the education of those principles of the gospel unto our people if this republic is to survive. My assessment bill did that, but it offered at the same time a profound religious liberty to all who worshiped in the religion of our Savior.
Mr. Henry waxes hyperbolically towards my intentions regarding the morality of people. I have long said the best way to teach morality is in the matters of religion. However, it is my devout opinion that the best way to secure one's liberty of conscience is to separate the matters of religion from the matters of state. It is as simple as that. For as man made government, it is man's responsibility to dictate government. Just as God made religion, it is up to the divine creator to determine, and man's own thought, to determine how best he is to worship. Now, Mr. Henry's assessment was by many instances a moral endeavor, and I do respect him for that. But I must reasonably say that in such matters we must go, of course, to that 16th article of the Declaration of Rights that specifically and explicitly states that religion, or the duty we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it, can be conducted only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. Therefore, all men are entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of his own conscience. This general assessment forced that taxes go to the establishment of Anglican and Episcopalian preachers. Now, you will let me finish, Mr. Henry, for I do and see that great intake of breath you mean to debate with me, and I will talk as I gave you some time to talk, sir. Such a bill favors one religion over another. Now, we have seen through the annals of time, time and time again, though men did endeavor to do well in legislating religion, they did more harm than good. For indeed, if we do deem to legislate religion and other such matters, how shall we deem which great sources to use? How shall we deem which books are canonical, which ones apocryphal? Shall we use the Hebrew, the Septuagint, the Vulgate? How do we navigate such a labyrinth? And for that reason, it must be kept entirely separate. Now, I realize man is a wicked thing, but we have also seen time and time again that Christianity has survived not only with legislation supporting it, but in spite of every opposition of it. So indeed, it was my belief that it be kept entirely separate, so that the rights of the minority may never be encroached by the will of the majority.
The greatest amount of the monies that had been collected prior to our declaring independence went to the care of the poor and the needy, the widows, the orphans, the sick, the dying, the indigent. Now that Mr. Jefferson's plan for religious freedom, which was pushed through the legislature by his creature, Mr. Madison, where are these monies going to come from to care for those in need? Do these gentlemen truly believe that there will be no longer any widows or orphans in our society, in our new republic? Or is their care going to have to fall to the responsibility of government? That, I believe, is far more dangerous than continuing to have religion as that manner in which the poor around us were cared for. Also, Mr. Madison deceives you. He suggests that my assessment bill was designed to strengthen one particular denomination. I presume you mean the Protestant Episcopal Church, but very clearly my assessment bill allowed each and every head of household to choose to which meeting house or church or minister he wished those monies to be applied. Sir, if my assessment bill had been successful in passing the legislature, and it was not owing to your intrigue, why then I dare say that all denominations would be flourishing around our countryside. And permit me, sir, to inform you as to the intrigue that I speak of. As we were going into the final debates to choose whether it was going to be Mr. Jefferson's plan or my assessment bill, Mr. Madison apparently suddenly had the the brainstorm that I had not held the office of governor for just more than 4 years. Thus, by our Constitution, I could be appointed to the office of governor for a fourth term, knowing that if I was nominated, I would have to accept. And that, of course, took me off the floor of debate, so that I could use not use my formidable powers of persuasion to push for my own bill. It rankles me, sir, still.
I will ask with this one last question of you, sir. Was your bill necessary for the support of civil government?
In a manner, yes. Because if we continue to see this decline in morality, sir, there will be no civil government any longer. We'll be reduced to a state of nature.
Mr. Henry, is the only source of civic virtue Christianity?
Yes.
Mr. Madison?
I should say virtue should be dictated by morality. And why we find such moral things in such Christian works. I should say our own intellect is given by that divine architect that does give us our measure of reason and intellect. We find such virtue in the works of Rousseau, of Montesquieu, and we have seen within our own legislation their hand as well as the hand of God. So I should say that it is indeed not the only measure of public virtue, but moreover our own reason being such, our own system of government, this proper checks and balances we have laid out in our new Constitution.
We were speaking earlier of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. One of the 15 or 16 articles that is most, well, close to my own heart is Article 15, which I wrote unassisted and unadvised. And it reads that no free government or the blessing of liberty can be preserved to any people but by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue, and by frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. Where, Mr. Madison, do we learn these principles? Where do we have these principles reinforced in us? Why, sir, that would occur during divine services at the local meeting house. It is religion that teaches us virtue and nothing but.
So the Jews, that great people, have they no morality? Do they have no moral compass? Are they excluded from this equation?
They are not. Well, in times past, the one Jew in all of Virginia, and he was the doctor who cared for the lunatics at the public hospital here in Williamsburg City, Dr. De Sequeira, in the old scheme of things, under royal authority, he too was required to pay an annual tax which would support the Church of England, the Bruton Parish here in Williamsburg, and he further was required by law to attend divine services at least 1 week in four or pay a fine. I assume he paid £3 a year in penalties. By my assessment bill, Dr. De Sequeira would not be required to contribute any monies to any particular Christian denomination. He would have the availability to have his monies placed towards a general fund, which would then go towards the erection and maintenance of public seminaries for learning, in which the fundamental principles of all religion, including that of the Hebrew faith, would be inculcated in our people, in our citizenry. I acknowledge fully that Christianity has its basis, has its roots in the Jewish religion. I remind myself frequently that our Savior, Jesus Christ, was a Jew himself until his passing, and it is my hope that the local citizenry of Williamsburg will be assiduous in trying to bring Dr. De Sequeira to the one true faith.
Mr. Madison, isn't Mr. Henry correct that we are a Christian nation?
Oh, indeed, I should say he is, and I go back to that 16th article of that final clause, saying that it is the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance to all. I make no disagreement with Mr. Henry, and indeed I agree with him in saying that the finest place to learn morality is indeed the fundamental principles of the Christian faith. I was brought into it, just as I'm certain every American has been. But moreover, I should say it is not the place of government to teach such things, but the church. And indeed, I expect as we bring up our children, our children bring up their children, they shall instill those principles. Mr. Henry, now that we have no state-sponsored religion, have you stopped going to church?
I was not a frequent churchgoer in the first place, but I still attend upon occasion.
And
yes,
do you
I
still
do.
Tithe?
I do contribute monies to my local parish.
To your local parish, sir?
Aye.
Aye, you do.
As well as to the academy, of which I am a trustee. A great amount of money, too.
And what becomes of those tithes, sir? If I may ask, sir.
Why, those monies are applied chiefly to the minister, so that he might be able to provide for his family while he is ministering to his local flock.
I see. Seriously, these tithes do not stop. People do not stop going to church. It is now they merely have the liberty to do so, and pick where, when, and how much they shall give. We still have those same means of enjoyment, but moreover, we have that freedom of conscience that keeps us in control of ourselves. If man is not master of his thought, he cannot be master of his actions. And if he cannot be master of his actions, how can he be accountable for them?
Mr. Henry, on several occasions you have made reference to Mr. Jefferson and to his relationship with Mr. Madison. I wonder if you'd care to explain that or expound upon it.
From Mr. Madison's earliest days in public life, he seemed to be drawn to Mr. Jefferson. And whenever Mr. Jefferson is not present in the assembly to argue for his own bills, for example, when he was in France, he could count upon Mr. Madison to do his business here. Again, I say that perhaps it's owing to their youth that they still have something of an ideological view of life, that they still have this view of mankind as being fundamentally good and pure and generous. And they certainly do resemble one another in many ways. Their bookishness, for example, which is extreme. Beg pardon, sir, but you should spend more time in the out-of-doors. And certainly I do not begrudge their friendship, but owing to the assessment bill battle, and I suppose also to the most recent debates in the Constitution, I seem to be on opposite sides of the aisle with the two of them at all times.
Mr. Madison, are you, in fact, Mr. Jefferson's creature?
Despite the accusations Mr. Henry has made throughout our entire conversation, I should say that Mr. Jefferson and I share many opinions, but I am my own man, so to say, in so many things, gifted with my own reason, my own education, and moreover, my own opinions. And I have found myself time and time again in Congress in agreement with Mr. Jefferson. But as I said before, he and I do not always see eye to eye, particularly on this matter of a Bill of Rights. However, I do take my honorable friend's estimations and opinions into account in my decisions, but ultimately, the decisions I do make are my own.
Speaking of prominent Virginians, I wonder if you could share with me your impressions of General Washington.
There's no man living that I revere more. I'm pleased to report that despite our political differences of opinion with regard to the formation of this consolidated government, I will say that General Washington is without doubt the chiefest supporter of that federal government, and no doubt owing to the frustrations that he experienced during the war with the Congress. But we have not allowed those political differences to interfere with our personal friendship, and I call it friendship. I dare say that there are few men who can make that boast, for General Washington can be a difficult man to figure. He's a man of very few words, and yet, frankly, in my own instance, I would say that for the first 9 years of my being acquainted with him, when we served in the House of Burgesses together, I don't think he had spoken a single word to me the entire time. So imagine my surprise when I was approached by him immediately following our elections to the first Congress. He and I were two of the seven. And he invited me to make that long journey to Philadelphia City with him, and I very eagerly accepted. We had 10 days to get from Williamsburg to Philadelphia City, and had a great deal of time to converse. I believe that our friendship began to be forged then. But then as the governor of Virginia, I came to his rescue, not once, but twice. One of those being alerting him of a terrible conspiracy against him, the Conway Cabal. And also, it was largely at my insistence that Virginia was able to raise up a great many provisions for the Continental Army and saw to their safe
transport to Valley Forge, where he was at winter quarters. He's confessed to me since that time that if I and, well, if Virginia had not acted in the manner in which we did, the Continental Army might have disbanded that winter. So we have sealed our friendship, and you may be pleased to know that on that occasion, just before the final vote was taken in Virginia, and it was close, as you may recall, the final vote ended up being 89-79 in favor of the Constitution. But I happened to be at the home of my half-brother, John Sim, with a number of other rather rabid anti-Federalists. And after dinner, it came to that period of time for the men to retire into the parlor and to begin drinking and toasting and conversing about politics and such like. Came time for the toast. The first toast is customarily given by the host of the affair, my half-brother. Whereupon he raised his glass and said, "Gentlemen, to the States," a very popular anti-Federalist toast at the time. Whereupon I put my glass down and rebuked my brother in front of his guests by saying, "What, brother? Not toasting General Washington first, as we always have done? For shame, brother, for shame. To General Washington." We all drank, and I have not spoken to my half-brother since that time, nor do I intend to.
Well, Mr. Madison, do you revere General Washington to the same degree?
I should say I do. Let it be known that though men like Mr. Henry and myself may differ on opinion so many times, we may never differ upon principle. And that principle stands that the unadulterated forms of republican government may always be cherished and perpetuated. And I believe we have seen the embodiment of that in His Excellency General George Washington himself, for indeed he is a man of modesty, a man of moderation, and a man who has given far more to his country than I believe any of us can conceive. Our friendship is a new thing. I began this endeavor as a young man, and indeed I am still quite young compared to many of my contemporaries. But I should say he and I worked very closely in discussing what is necessary in regards to a federal government. It began in 4 years ago now, discussing plans for the establishment of a canal that should run between Maryland and Virginia. And we witnessed there, for indeed it was an unlawful meeting, the problems in negotiating between states. And so he and I kept in correspondence for that time, determining what indeed could be done. He was integral throughout the entire process of establishing this new federal government and was indeed ever in favor of it. Indeed, I recall one instance, a dour day at the convention in Philadelphia, where a man stood up, Gunning Bedford, it was, I think, who stated that if they could not reach any form of agreement, or if the small states did not receive an equal vote, that they should secede and find a foreign ally. Now, His Excellency, who had not said very much during the convention, he was elected speaker, and so his role was smaller than many, stood up from his chair, and you could feel the fury emanating from his person. The entire room grew silent, and he sat back down. So ardent is his hope for this republic, for this union, for the collaboration of these states, that I expect indeed it should have failed many times before had he not been present.
Gentlemen, our time is drawing to a close, and with all due respect, Mr. Madison, I'm going to honor Mr. Henry's advanced years and give him the last word. Do you have any summation, any final thoughts to add to our conversation, sir?
Thank you, sir. I will always consider myself to be the servant of the people of Virginia, as a sentinel over their rights, their liberty, and their happiness. And I represent their feelings when still, even though the Constitution has been ratified, that the public mind, as well as my own, is exceedingly uneasy at this proposed change of government. We have established, however, a republic, and as a true Republican, I naturally submit to the will of the majority. I have
already pledged my allegiance to these United States and resolved to be the most peaceable of all United States citizens hereafter. But I exhort the citizenry of not only Virginia, but of all of these United States, to be ever vigilant, because history shows us that power corrupts. History also shows us that those men who have some power always want more.
That was just absolutely fantastic, gentlemen, fantastic. It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and we have just finished. Wasn't that a wonderful debate with Patrick Henry and James Madison? I was just thrilled the entire time. I wish you could have seen me sitting there with my big, silly grin on my face. After the break, we'll come back and we'll speak to the actual living, breathing human beings who interpret those two giants of history. So stay tuned. You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional, and we've just finished up a fascinating debate between James Madison and Patrick Henry all about whether the Constitution should be ratified. Now let's speak to the two interpreters from Colonial Williamsburg who brought those two titans to life.
Mr. Henry is actually Richard Schumann, and I have had the profound privilege to portray this great man for these last going on 18 years now.
Good heavens.
Here at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. Henry is a lot of fun, especially when we do talk about the Constitution. Fortunately, there are transcripts. Almost every word that could be heard is recorded in these transcripts. That's why there's so much Madison missing. But when I look at the prophecies that Mr. Henry was making during the ratifying convention in 1788, and compare those to the headlines of the newspapers we're picking up today, it's just uncanny at how amazing a prophet he was. And I can't tell you how often people come to me after my public audience and say something to the effect of, oh, come on, you were just making that up, right? You were just making that up. No, friends. History repeats itself over and again.
How does one become the interpreter of Patrick Henry at Colonial Williamsburg? What is your background, sir?
Well, I fell into it quite by happenstance. I do have a strong theater background. I studied acting in New York City at the Herbert Berghoff Studio, and in fact went to an audition one day up there that brought me to, of all places, Yorktown, Virginia. It was during the bicentennial of the Yorktown battlefield. That was 1981, and my first foray into living history. And, there just was an opening about 18 years ago. It happened to coincide with my change of career. And
whom did you portray at Yorktown, if I may ask?
Thomas Nelson, Jr., signer of the Declaration of Independence, who had a fine home there. In fact, his home was being used by Lord Cornwallis as his headquarters for a period of time until Thomas Nelson ordered to knock it down.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Oh, it's a great story. Great story.
Well, then tell it if it's a great story. What's the great story?
Well, at the time, General Nelson was the commander-in-chief of the Virginia militia, and he had also replaced Jefferson as governor of the Commonwealth of Virginia. And to order cannon to fire upon his own home, knowing that Cornwallis was probably still inside, I just think is really a kick. That this man, who was one of 56 who signed his name to a document asserting that he pledges his life, his fortune, and his
sacred honor,
to a dream against unimaginable odds, he really meant it.
He really meant he was putting it on the line. I recall a similar story about Washington, where there was a British ship nearby in the Potomac, and there was some discussion among Washington's household staff that they were going to go down there and do something to appease them so that they wouldn't destroy Mount Vernon. And when Washington heard about that, he was livid. At least that's in broad strokes what it was. So Washington was willing to put Mount Vernon on the line. He knew he might come back to ruins. So apparently this fellow did too. Well, that's fantastic. Mr. Madison, who are you, sir?
Hi, I'm Brian Austin. I've been portraying Mr. Madison for about 2 years now.
Wow, now that's impressive. That's impressive that you're as good as you are with so much less experience than Richard has. I mean, because you were really good.
Thank you. It's a terrifying feat. It really is. You've got so many of this little man left existing, so much of his writing, mm-hmm. So much of what he thought, so much of what he was saying, that he had 80-some years to live in his skin. So to endeavor to put it together in two is, it's Herculean. And so I'm happy if I can just sort of get a fraction of that, because he really was such an intelligent man, and a man who, throughout most of his life, sort of just liked sitting on the back burner of it, of just sort of being, at the basis of that great pyramid and just letting things go. So you have all these guys who sort of take credit for things, who are known for these specific things, and then you have in the background James Madison, who's helping out with it, who's, writing inaugural addresses, who's passing legislation through, who's sitting at the foundation of all of these things that are, as he puts it, epochs of mm-hmm. the nation's destiny. And the reason he's doing it is simply because he wants to perpetuate the union of the states. And so there really is this altruistic quality to this man that I really just love. Yeah. Like Richard was saying, and he put it so beautifully, you see as you read through these guys were so smart and they saw so many things coming. They really, you can draw so many parallels between today and yesterday in that respect. And you really see that these things that are fundamental problems of human nature, these guys were entirely aware of as well. And it's extraordinary to see.
It is indeed. How did you come to this?
In the weirdest way, truth be told.
I studied acting.
I went to Christopher Newport University, some 30 minutes to the south, mm-hmm. and I did the professional theater thing for about my first 2 years out of college. Right before this, I found myself between contracts. I was actually at a circus school in California.
A circus school. So what were you going to do?
Physical theater. I was studying at Del Arte International. I had no idea. I was just doing it to fill some time. I drove cross country.
Oh, I've got a little time, so I'm going to go to circus school.
Like you do. It's fine.
Yeah, like you do. Sure.
I had a Skype interview for a full-time position as one of our orientation interpreters. They check tickets. They talk to guests. They basically get them acclimated to the historic area. They're the people. They're sort of the front lines. You see them
here,
in costume.
Here at Williamsburg.
Yes, okay. Absolutely. My first day on the job there, I found out I had an audition as an actor interpreter. They set me up with it. About a month later, they told me I'd be playing young James Madison, which was okay. I was okay with that at that point because I only had to cover the period of 1785 to 1781.
Right.
And that's where I started my studies, which wasn't terrifying simply because Madison really was sort of just beginning. He was mm-hmm. just getting started. I didn't have to know everything. And then they approached me about a month later after that and said, we'd like you to be able to cover everything with Madison. Full Constitution, Secretary of State, Presidency, War of 18.
And that's when you just went back to your room and assumed a fetal position.
More or less, yeah. I spent about 2 months in 9-to-5 research, reading everything from Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the Federalist Papers, biographies of Madison for fun, mm-hmm. All it said. And like I said, I've got maybe a fraction of the guy. I remember I was peeing my pants a little bit because I knew I had to debate with Richard, who is just a master when it comes to Henry.
He's kind of scary, isn't he?
He's very scary. He's very scary. So I was. You saw me with my little book reading away because he was making these brilliant points, and I was like, all right, let's see, what do I got for this?
Yeah, you were going through your cheat sheet there. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, that was very, very nice. Well, obviously everyone who's listening can tell what great actors you are and what great portrayals you're giving, and very realistic. But they can't see is that you both look like your respective characters. You really and truly do. I can see why they picked both of you, not merely because of your talent, but because you really do both fit the roles, and you fit them very, very well.
Well, the other various divisions around Colonial Williamsburg help a lot with that. The wig that I'm currently wearing, for example, was made by hand by the ladies in the wig shop, and they were basing it upon probably the best known portrait, some could argue the only real portrait of Patrick Henry from the Thomas Sully portrait. And then, you know, the spectacles, which he commonly wears upon the top of his head.
Right.
And our costume design center, all that gets put together. These people are doing meticulous research, and so that sure helps us.
Plus, you got that killer Henry profile too.
The nose. It's all the nose.
It's all the nose. I see. Well, please.
Oh, for me, it's hard. There's only so much I can do. But Madison is notoriously the shortest president.
Right.
He was 5 foot nothing, and he was never more than 100 pounds.
Right.
And I am not that at all. I'm about 5'7" and 180 on a good day.
Right.
So, but you know, it's
well, no one's perfect.
It's true.
No one's perfect, and as we all know, and I hate to say this, Richard, but the finest constitutional scholars are in fact short. I think that's axiomatic. So I think that Madison gets the tip in that regard. There's no question.
Very well.
Tremendous. Well, you guys, I have to say that I'm left with a strong sense of admiration and gratitude for what you're doing, because I think it's very important. And of course, also envy. One of these days, I'm going to have to get me some knee breeches, and I'm going to have to do some of that stuff, because this is awfully, awfully fun. It really is. It looks like you guys are just having a ball.
It sure beats working for a living.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Wow, that has to be one of my favorite interviews, or my favorite pair of interviews I've ever done. We've got just a minute or two left in the show, and that leaves us with a little bit of time to talk to Bill White, who's in charge of all these folks at Williamsburg, and who is going to tell us about The Idea of America, a new publication available from Colonial Williamsburg.
Well, The Idea of America is the notion that America, at its very heart and soul, is an enduring debate, a debate that begins before the Revolution and continues today. And what's important about this debate is that it's about values that every American believes in. The problem with our debate is that the values that we love are actually in conflict or tension with each other. We ask for teachers and students to take a look, for example, at the balance between individual freedom and equality. Every American believes in individual freedom. It's the watch cry of the Revolution. Give me liberty or give me death.
Yep.
But we all know that the individual cannot be completely, totally free. Because one individual in a group who's completely free stomps on the rights and privileges of everybody else in the group. We temper our freedom. We limit our freedom. And quite often we do that with equality. But we don't actually believe that we're all equal either. Americans believe that there are differences between individuals, and we actually celebrate the fact that we're not all the same. So we believe in freedom and we believe in equality. We just know that there's a place where we can get the most individual freedom and the most equality. And we talk constantly about where that right place is. Sometimes we push farther to the side of the individual and freedom, and sometimes we push farther to the side of equality. But we just know that we can balance those two things. We don't have to pick one thing or the other.
That's what makes your institution so important. That's what makes Colonial Williamsburg so important, is that that's what you're telling people. You're telling the young people especially, you know, you've got to pick up your part of this. You've got to engage in the conversation. You've got to bring your values to the debate, because people did it before you. And that's why you've got this great country, and you've got to preserve it and protect it for future generations.
Now, it's your responsibility.
Yes, it is. That is your responsibility. We're free, but that comes with responsibility.
Yeah, it's a legacy.
I think Spider-Man said that, right?
Yeah.
Well, Bill, thanks.
A wise man.
Oh, very wise. It was actually his gentle Uncle Ben. Just want to be clear here, but it was a wise sentiment. Thank you very, very much for your time,
thank
Bill.
You.
Appreciate it.
Certainly.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to our good friends at Colonial Williamsburg, Bill White, we just spoke to, and before that, the interpreters of Patrick Henry, who is, of course, Richard Schumann, and of James Madison, who is Brian Austin. What a great job they did. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Nick Rosa. Our theme music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.